Hello, I'm Dave Musgrave, and this is the fourth History Extra podcast for May 2012. Thank you for listening. Coming up in this week's episode, we have...
Clearly, I think he found that, and he decided pretty quickly, that he couldn't serve the Archbishopric and God and Henry at the same time.
That was John Guy talking about Thomas Becket.
Because the funny thing is, if you don't have anything to drink, you don't make much saliva. And when you don't have any saliva, you don't eat anything.
Those were the words of a Second World War veteran. This podcast is brought to you from the team behind BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. There are details of our latest issue and subscription deals on our website, which is historyextra.com. We're also available digitally. You can purchase our Kindle edition direct from the Amazon website, and our iPad edition is available from the Apple newsstand. To find out more, please visit historyextra.com. .com/iPad for that. We're also on facebook.com/historyextra and twitter.com/historyextra. John Guy, best known as a historian of Tudor England, has turned his attention in his latest book to one of the most intriguing figures of the medieval period. Thomas Becket was a middle-class merchant's son who rose to become Archbishop of Canterbury before being murdered in 1170 at the behest, some argue, of King Henry II. He then went on to become a martyr of great renown. BBC History Magazine's Rob Attar caught up with John recently to find out what new light he had shed on Becket, his relationship with the king, and his untimely death.
What new perspectives do you think you can bring to the story of Becket with your experience as a Tudor historian?
I think from the outset I was interested in his reading, because clearly the key thing for him is, what was it that was driving him? You know, what was his interior world like? What was going on in his head? And I was very cautious also that I wasn't simply going to try and map on Tudor controversies to the 12th century. But right from the beginning, it was fascinating to discover that not only did he have books, but he actually had 70 books, which is rather a lot for the 12th century. And in fact, when he was killed, his books, what was left of his property after it had been looted by the knights and their accomplices, what was left of his property became the property of the Christchurch monks at Canterbury. And in the early 14th century, an inventory, a catalogue, was made of his books. So we can see what they are. And not only that, I was able to trace six or seven of the exact books that he had owned.
The actual books.
Yes, with his name written in the front in the early 14th century by Prior Eastry. This is one of the books that belonged to Thomas the Martyr, rubbed out, of course, because Henry VIII in 1538 said that the name of Thomas Becket should be no more used, and the shrine was dismantled, and so the names were rubbed out, but you can still see with ultraviolet light. Of course, if you look at the whole package, and he had things, for example, like St. Ambrose on the duty of ministers, which is a reworking in a Christian frame of Cicero's book on duties, De Officiis. He also had Seneca's moral essays, including De Clemencia, which of course was written under the Emperor Nero as a guide to how an honest citizen should behave under tyranny. It's actually quite clear that the sort of package which comes with this section of his library is the package that comes when somebody is exploring how to deal with a sovereign power that they believe has degenerated into a tyranny. Now, if you correlate Becket's reading against his letters, you in fact find in the letters this rhetoric of Henry II becoming a tyrant, and behaving, in fact, in the way that King Stephen had behaved against the church and so on, during the anarchy. And so it enables you to create a vision or at least recreate or reimagine his vision of the world. And in fact, you can say that Henry II had a vision of the world which involved a centralised state, and he was able to control the church, ring-fence by the coast and exclude appeals to Rome and limit the encroachments of canon law on the secular law. You can see these two guys had conflicting visions of the world, and that transcends the struggle to be something more than just simply a clash of personalities. It's also intriguing to me as a Tudor historian that Thomas More was reading the same books.
So are there quite a lot of parallels between Thomas More and Beckett?
Well, when I was researching the book and when I was writing it, I was trying not to draw too much on that. In fact, a couple of places where I do refer to these parallels, but I'm trying not consciously not to over-egg those parallels, because I don't want what I know about the Tudors and a later Henry to be driving what I'm thinking about Beckett and Henry II in the 12th century. But sure, there are parallels there. What's really clever about Henry II is how he manages also to get things airbrushed out of history. Until I wrote this book, at Cambridge, I'd always been a medievalist, primarily as a student. I read virtually all medieval history in only one Tudor history course. Only later that I became a Tudor historian. But what I never knew, and what has almost got airbrushed out of history, is that after the Beckett controversy, when Henry had to, in fact, do penance in the cathedral at Vranches and had to be reconciled to the church, he actually was forced to take an oath, to swear an oath of obedience to the Pope on behalf of himself and the monarchy. But he got that airbrushed out of history.
So from doing this research, have you found you've shed quite a lot of new light on Beckett and Henry?
Most British scholars believe that Beckett was something of a hypocrite because he'd been Chancellor before and he'd done what Henry wanted, he was something of a pretender, he was ill-qualified to be our Archbishop, he was therefore, because of his, if you like, his personality defects, he was keen to outbishop the bishops, he was a bit of an actor saint, he was essentially a pretender. I think that's actually very harsh. And I think a lot of that is owed to the sort of anti-Beckett propaganda that came out at the time of Henry VIII's break with Rome, and then in the Elizabethan period with the Protestant Reformation, when there was a sort of great flood of campaigns to rubbish or diminish the importance of Beckett. But of course, also in the 1530s, at the time of Henry VIII's break with Rome, Beckett got a rough deal from the papacy as well. Because, of course, by then their view of what martyrdom should involve had shifted a bit. And Beckett, of course, was accused of dying simply to protect the privileges and assets of the cathedral and the Church of Canterbury. And, in fact, not to die for a significant point of faith, and that this was inferior. And in fact, actually, Pope Paul III, at the time of the executions of More and Fisher, says, well, Fisher is a proper martyr, not like Beckett, who basically threw his life away in a sort of petty squabble over property and assets and a dispute about who was going to crown the young heir to the throne, the young Prince Henry, whom Henry had crowned in his own lifetime.
Do you think Beckett was put in an impossible position by the conflicting demands of the Pope and Henry?
Well, of course. And it's also said of him that he politicised the archbishopric. I mean, I think you've got to go back a stage, actually, and say, was Beckett exactly as Chancellor Henry's man and doing Henry's business? And that there was this sudden sort of transformation in which he suddenly became a new man. The idea of the early biographers of Beckett all said, he became a new man and it was a Damascene conversion like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. So you've got to take a step back from that. Because if you look at the person who knew Beckett best in his own lifetime and had been a fellow clerk with him in Archbishop Theobald's household, Archbishop Theobald being the previous Archbishop to Beckett. And John of Salisbury, if you read something like his There's a long Enthetikos, which is a sort of abstract of wise men's doctrine, and which he never showed to anybody, as far as we know. It was essentially a private piece of writing. But there's also a dedication to Becket, a verse dedication of 306 lines, and the copy of John of Salisbury's Polycraticus, which he sent to Becket in 1159 by courier when Becket was at the gates of Toulouse in the Toulouse campaign. John of Salisbury characterises Becket as a divided consciousness under Henry as Chancellor, that in fact, he goes as far as to say that Becket's career as Chancellor is something of a pious fraud, because he has to pretend to essentially be one of the untamed beasts of the court and then go along with Henry and be Henry's man, whereas in fact he's actually trying to turn things round, you know, for the better. There's a little bit of wishful thinking in that, but there's an element also in which Becket is not the sort of cipher or basically royal slave that he's often appeared to be in sort of film and television. And I mean, he's certainly not Henry in sexual matters. I mean, he's certainly someone, for example, who, as far as we can tell, whatever he'd been like as a student in Paris, is not engaged in sexual relationships. I mean, he seems to be chaste while he's chancellor. And I mean, he's not even, I mean, as once he becomes an archdeacon of Canterbury, you know, then, which is, of course, not a full priest. The deacon is not a full priest. It's sort of halfway there. To be chaste even as a deacon is quite remarkable in the 12th century. So I think you have to step back a bit. Once Becket had become Archbishop, clearly I think he found that, and he decided pretty quickly, that he couldn't serve the Archbishopric and God and Henry at the same time. And indeed he didn't need to continue to be Chancellor, and he resigns within, 4 or 5 months of being made Archbishop. He just resigns the chancellor. It was quite a bold thing to do in the 12th century. I mean, Thomas More, it was quite a bold thing for Thomas More to do, to resign the chancellorship. Yeah. You didn't just resign. You couldn't just resign. Machiavelli understood this very well when he said that essentially if you go and serve princes, you have to do exactly what they say, otherwise you tend to get your head chopped off. You know, you can't afford to be a conscientious objector or anything like that. And I think that was Becket's main offence, actually. I mean, there were many things that Becket was accused of by Henry, but I think the biggest offence that he had was that he actually resigned without first consulting Henry. Henry, of course, at the time was in Normandy, but on the continent. And Becket was in England. And I think it was a great shock, actually, to Henry that Becket had resigned.
So do you think Becket was a more consistent character than some of his biographers would claim, that he didn't necessarily have this big change, that he was always a fairly similar man?
I certainly agree. And actually, I'm not the first person to say that he was a divided consciousness before he became Archbishop. David Knowles had written a quite short biography in the 1970s. He'd said pretty much the same, and I think that this is right. I think the difference with my book is that I show you where in John of Salisbury this was said at the time. You can also triangulate this a bit further, because if you bring in, there's another courtier bishop, a Norman courtier bishop, who was very influential in Normandy and advised Henry even before Henry became King of England, when he was still Count of Anjou and Duke of Normandy. And this is Arnulf of Lisieux, Bishop of Lisieux.
Yeah.
And Arnulf says, he writes to Becket as things start to go wrong, and he says, well, look, you know, why are you really surprised? I mean, look at Henry is a king who stands so much on his dignity, on his honour. Who are you? You're just a middle-class Londoner, you know, who's, you know, hit the jackpot and become Chancellor. And, the social gulf between you is so great that, do you really suppose that, you know, and Henry's so willful and he's so volcanic and, you know, he's so clear about his aims and so fixed of purpose that you really, you know, how did you ever really think that you could actually sort of ride this very, very difficult horse? Of course, Becket says of Henry that he's a tester of character, and you have to basically stand up to him a bit. What Becket understands is that blind sycophancy doesn't go down well with Henry either. He wants someone whom he can actually respect, even though he wishes to still control him. He wants someone who he can respect for a certain amount of genuine independent advice. And Henry will actually, even when you give him advice he doesn't always want to hear, he will often respect you for giving you genuine advice. What he can't stand is what he sees as treachery. or betrayal. If you give him genuine advice from the heart. This relationship, I think, with Beckett was much more complicated before he became what he was still Chancellor. You see, I mean, really, all the early biographers skew this a bit because, you know, they all say they were great. They say they were great friends, but William Fitzstephen in particular says they were the closest of friends. They were like brothers. They worked together. They played together. They hunted together. They ate together. You know, Henry would come to eat at Beckett's in Beckett's hall. You know, he'd ride his horse into the hall, and he'd vault over the tables. You know, they'd slap each other over the back, and they would be great chums and all the rest of that. And Fitzstephen's incredibly vivid about this, but Fitzstephen can't actually give us one, it's all generalities actually, he can't give us one solid anecdote in which he actually tells us chapter and verse of how this friendship actually worked. He does give us one solid anecdote, and it's how the friendship didn't work. When they're riding out together one day, and Henry says to Beckett, you know, look, there's a beggar here, you know, wouldn't it be fine if, you know, he had a nice new cloak? And Beckett says, oh, well, it well behoves the king, you know, to think and say that. And Henry says, well, great, you know, it's your cloak, matey, that, you know, he's going to get. And he pulls it off him, and there's a struggle. And actually, it gets quite ugly, and the because Beckett's got this brand new cloak, really expensive, and he likes it, lined with fur. And the guards run up, and actually, it looks as if there's a serious bit of trouble. And of course, what Henry is doing is he's actually using this as a sort of way of publicly humiliating and controlling Beckett, and actually showing him who is the boss. I mean, Henry uses techniques of psychological control of the people around him. And although Beckett, as you see, said to Arnulf, and to others, that, oh, Henry's a tester of character and you have to stand up to him, and he doesn't stand for blind sycophancy. Of course, Arnulf of Lisieux says, yeah, well, that's all very well, but a point will come when Henry will have one set of aims and you've got a set of other aims, and they'll diametrically clash, and then a right royal, you know, struggle will emerge. And of course, that's exactly what happens. I get to this in two stages. First, I come to the friendship, and I actually say, I cast doubt on how sort of rosy this friendship was. I think that when Henry was young, Beckett, of course, is what, you know, roughly 12 years older. Henry comes to this friendship. He's quite young. You know, he's incredibly, for his age, he is, you know, weathered and quite experienced, but he's still relatively inexperienced in the great scheme of things. I mean, and Beckett has had to cope with being Archbishop Theobald's right-hand man and fixer, you know, during the whole time of the worst bits of the anarchy of the Civil War. As a young king, I think Henry was probably more flexible. He was more willing to be advised. You know, his aims weren't absolutely, you know, set in stone. Beckett is able to steer him a bit. But of course, also I think Beckett is rather naive, and he is naive enough to think that this is a special relationship because Henry finds him useful. I think Beckett thinks that actually they could really be friends, and William Fitzstephen, who's one of Beckett's clerks, you know, writes that version of the story. And of course, Fitzstephen also does it to make Henry look bad after they've quarrelled. I mean, there's an element of hagiography coming into this. You know, I mean, Fitzstephen plays up the good relationship in order to, you know, throw mud at Henry when things have gone wrong and sort of blame him for much of that. But I think when Henry got older, of course, he became much more independent in his thinking, and he didn't need Beckett so much, and he was going to subject him to the sort of psychological controls that he has for everyone else. I mean, you can also point to moments when there is a collision even before Beckett becomes Archbishop. I mean, in 1159, Henry raises an army, and, you know, Beckett helps him, and they go down essentially to recapture the city of Toulouse and restore it to the Duchy of Aquitaine, from which it has been detached. And while they're camped outside the walls of Toulouse, which is quite a difficult city to besiege, and then just as they're there, King Louis, who is Henry's feudal overlord, actually comes into the city and sort of joins the defence. So, I mean, you know, it's very awkward for Henry to have to capture a city in which he's again going to capture his feudal overlord. That's actually incredibly difficult for him. And actually Beckett and Henry have a big row in the Council of War in front of the barons as to basically, you know, are they going to actually attack the city, or are they going to basically just leave it and go off and do something else? And Beckett wants to take the city, and regardless of the fact that Louis is in it, and Henry decides that he doesn't want to be that militarily or politically exposed at that minute. So it wasn't necessarily all sweetness and light beforehand. You see, a lot of the thing is that we've given a lot of weight to. In a nutshell, I think we've given too much weight to the earliest biographies of Beckett, most of which were essentially written by hagiographers or people, who were out to. They had an agenda, and we've given too little credit to actually rather objective, relatively sources like the Letters of Arnulf of Lisieux, which actually tell you a different story. See, the social gulf between Henry and Beckett is part of the problem. Once the quarrel has started, Henry's always going to say, I've raised you up from nothing. You're a guy I've raised up from nothing, and now you've basically come and kicked me in the teeth. And then he will say, even before the quarrel has reached its height, he's talking to Beckett and saying, are you not the son of one of my villains? And Beckett actually is rather proud of his middle-class ancestry. He defends his parentage and says actually that these are, respectable people, making a good living, and they're a decent pedigree. And actually, what do family trees matter? What do family trees, what does ancestry really amount for in the great scheme of things? The apostles were all humble men, and yet they were chosen by Christ.
So in a way, the relationship between Beckett and Henry was maybe never as strong as people think it was. So the breakdown wasn't quite as severe, because it wasn't this great relationship to break down.
That it's central to my argument that this wonderful friendship was not quite the wonderful friendship that it's made out to be by William Fitzstephen. And of course, many of the other early biographers copied from William Fitzstephen. So it's really quite hard to know how much corroboration there is there anyway. In the first place, it's true that there's another biographer who wrote in old French called Guernes of Ponts Saint-Maxence. He also has this idea of a good friendship, although he had used Fitzstephen. But I throw, like, this is one of the things that I do. I basically go about this in two stages. I cast doubt on the idea that this friendship had ever been quite the friendship that had previously been thought, and cite chapter and verse and the letters of Arnulf of Lisieux. And then I go on to argue that the conversion of Beckett into a different type of figure was actually much slower and much more complex. And was in fact in relation also to the sort of advice he was getting from people like Herbert of Bosham, who's another of his clerks and who is his divinity, his scripture tutor, and John of Salisbury, who is someone who is advising him as he's previously advised Archbishop Theobald, but of course is particularly pushing Beckett into reading moral philosophy. And of course, moral philosophy means for John of Salisbury means Cicero, or in a Christian context, St. Ambrose, and it means Seneca. And if you read St. Ambrose and you read Seneca, then when you're faced with an overarching sovereign power that is essentially acting tyrannically, you will create the mindset that Beckett actually had. And once you've got not just simply a collision of personalities, because clearly there was some collision of personalities, because Henry was absolutely furious that Beckett had resigned, and Beckett was determined to stand his ground. And in the early stages of the quarrel, there is a bit of tit for tat on relatively personal grounds, and that's, there's no doubt about it. But it's very quickly is subsumed and transmuted by this, ideological polarisation. And in a way, I suppose that has to be the reason why Beckett, for the next sort of four centuries, is seen as the iconic figure of resistance to a tyrannical king. And it's actually quite by chance. Actually, after I finished the book, this isn't in the book, I was reading Andy Wood's book on the rebellions of 1549 in Tudor England, and discovering the fact that Kett's rebellion began at Wyndham with a production of the play of St. Thomas Becket. Even though, of course, Becket had been outlawed and banned and so on in 1538, Becket is still seen in the mid 16th century. Becket's seen as the iconic figure of resistance to a tyrannical government.
So, do you think it's fair to describe Henry as a tyrant in his behaviour?
Well, that, of course, that's the point of view. Part of this book is also that as well as reassessing Beckett, it reassesses Henry. And the full extent, I mean, Anne Duggan, who's a great expert on the 12th century and has written on Beckett and has edited the magisterial edition of the two. I couldn't have written this book without Anne Duggan's edition of The Letters of Beckett, which is a very detailed scholarly reorganisation and redating and, in many cases, retranslating of Beckett's letters as Archbishop. You can see from the letters, which lead you right into the heart of the controversy, that Henry not only is a regular oath breaker. I mean, he's been an oath breaker really from the early years of his reign. I mean, in one year, I think 1157, he does it three times. And there's a very well-known biographer, actually, of Henry called Warren. Professor Warren, who, of course, had pointed this out before. But, I mean, the Beckett correspondence leads you to see that Henry's twists and turns, feints, lies. I mean, he lies and cheats his way out of everything and always postpones. He will weasel words are his stock in trade. He will promise the Pope this, that and the other, but, try not to deliver. He will, if Beckett reproaches him, he appeals to the Pope. He's constantly playing every trick of the power game in order to get an advantage. And in fact, I mean, this is one of the reasons why the controversy lasts so long, of course, and can't be settled. I mean, why does the final peace, the final reconciliation, I mean, they have three big shots at it. And the third one is the one that 1170, which is the one July 1170, which is the one that looks as if it has the best mileage in it. But of course, it comes to grief because really, Beckett isn't sure whether Henry can actually be trusted to keep his word. There's a lot of evidence, in fact, that he can't be trusted to keep his word, that he promises he will restore the property and so on of the Church of Canterbury to Beckett and the people whose property has been sequestrated because they're Beckett's supporters and they've been exiled onto the continent. He doesn't bring his courtiers into line to restore the property in a fair way. Of course, Beckett also, elated at the prospect of a settlement in 1170, takes the rather extreme position of saying that he wants every single yard of Canterbury ground restored to him before, he'll just basically go back, which is a bit foolish because he has to eat his words and go back anyway. And clearly too much has been taken. I doubt if Henry could even have afforded to restore every little bit of, because the courtiers have got quite a lot of it. Henry is a guy who I reinterpret because, I mean, although he's often seen, really Anglo-American lawyers in the 19th century looked at Henry II through rose-tinted spectacles and said that he's somebody who reforms the legal system, introduces impartial justice and fairness and jury trial and all the rest. I think this doesn't stand up. I mean, Henry, on a matter that affects him and his prerogative, expects to be chief prosecutor, judge and jury in his own court. There's a big dispute called the Battle Abbey case, while Beckett's chancellor, a really brilliant medieval historian at University of East Anglia called Nicholas Vincent. His take on the Battle Abbey case is that much of the chronicle, which we believe to be genuine even though the Abbey's chances were forged, much of the Abbey's chronicle is suspect, and in fact chunks of it were forged and were actually forged to create a context for the forged charters into which they were set. In other words, there are these forged charters. There is some sort of case, and there's no doubt that there was a case about these charters because there's a reconciliation in the document. But the fact of the matter is that this chronicle, is suspect. And of course, this is the chronicle in which Beckett is supposed to have given this sort of speech, essentially taking Henry's side, if you like, on the church as chancellor. Of course, if you prove that the chronicle is, if you prove, and this is rather played into the hands of a revision of Beckett, because if you prove that the chronicle is forged, then you can't prove that Beckett was a hypocrite anymore for essentially taking Henry's part on the, on a tough line on the church while he was chancellor, and then change when he's archbishop, because if the chronicle's suspect, we don't know. anymore. I mean, it is true that Beckett, it is true, and actually it's also, that makes a lot of sense because John of Salisbury doesn't mention the Battle Abbey case. You know, you'd expect the people who normally tell you things, you know, in newsletters or give you information about the period to mention this, and in fact they don't really. What we do know is that Beckett collected, and Scutage is basically a tax for the war, and it's essentially commuting the obligation to provide knights by providing cash instead. And we know that Beckett collects scutage for Henry, and we know that he collects it quite punitively against the church. And I mean, John of Salisbury criticised him for that, but even John of Salisbury excused him to the point where he says that, well, you know, he had no choice because this is basically Henry told him to do it, and he either had to do it or, you know, he was finished. So it's not an excuse, but it's an explanation. But I mean, it's like rather like when I wrote about Mary Queen of Scots. I mean, I wrote about Mary Queen of Scots in a way that was very different to what had gone before. But I also wrote about Elizabeth in a way that was different to what had gone before. Once you start moving the furniture about, when you actually go right back to the original sources and try and piece things together back from first principles, once you start moving the furniture, in fact, it can be that everything changes. So just as Elizabeth changed as well as Mary, in this Henry's changed as well as Beckett. And I see Beckett as having much more to contend with Henry than anybody probably has previously thought. Although Anne Duggan has hinted at this in the past, I have to say. Anne Duggan is the historian, far more than Barlow, Frank Barlow, who wrote about Beckett in 1986. And Duggan has hinted that Henry was essentially untrustworthy. And I absolutely agree with her. And I mean, I think the viewpoint that, I mean, you asked me the question, do I think Henry was a tyrant? I mean, that's the point of view. Beckett certainly thought he was a tyrant. And Beckett reckoned he knew a tyrant when he saw one because of his experiences in King Stephen's reign. Because, I mean, it isn't Beckett who, this is another, you know, huge misconception about Beckett. He was not the first archbishop to politicise the archbishopric, you know, after Lanfranc and Anselm and so on. I mean, Anselm hadn't really politicised it because, although he'd been in clashes with both William Rufus and with Henry I, Anselm basically believed that the archbishop's duty was to be a pastor and not a politician. Whereas Archbishop Theobald, during the anarchy of Stephen's reign, clearly becomes a politician. And Archbishop Theobald clearly is the kingmaker in 1154. He's the guy that basically brokers, with Beckett as his right-hand man and fixer, brokers this deal whereby Stephen accepts that he can remain king during his lifetime, but that the succession will go to Henry of Anjou and not to his own son, well, actually Eustace dies, but to his younger son, William, that basically that he will adopt, as it were, in inverted commas, he will adopt Henry of Anjou as his heir. And Theobald brokers that compromise. And then, of course, Theobald gets Beckett made chancellor. Beckett becomes chancellor, not because Henry necessarily wants to put it or knows that much about him, because Theobald talks him into it, because Theobald wants a guy there who will essentially protect the interests of the church under the new king, to enable Theobald to retire from being, if you like, the political archbishop to being more of the pastoral archbishop in his old age. And he'll have, he'll have a friend and protector at court who will ensure that he can actually stay a pastor and not actually have to get involved in politics again. But of course, the world has changed. The archbishopric has become political. I mean, Archbishop Theobald is the archbishop who's chased, you know, along the Thames, basically, when he's fleeing from an angry Stephen. He's chased by 12 angry knights with swords, you know, drawn, basically trying to assassinate him. It would be perfectly understandable how, at the end of Stephen's reign, if Theobald had actually been, I mean, according to the Beck Abbey Chronicle, or a bit inserted into it, according to a life of Theobald, there's a life of Theobald that's interpolated into the Beck Abbey Chronicle. According to this, you know, Stephen said, you know, well, I'm not going to kill Theobald, but I don't really care if anybody else does it. You know, and which is, you know, not exactly comparable with what Henry II, you know, said at Blois. It's not quite comparable, but nonetheless, I mean, Theobald is chased by 12 angry knights, and you know, you can't really argue with you know with this. I mean, the world has changed, and See, in Lanfranc and Anselm's time, church and state worked together, and the king worked with the archbishop, and it was like a team. But everything that had happened with the ascetic reform movement and the lay investiture contest, and you know, the rise of the power of the papacy and canon law and the sort of more exclusive positions that were taken by the church over jurisdiction, it just wasn't going to work like that anymore. And Henry, I mean, when Henry II claims to be simply in enforcing the customs of his grandfather, you know, Henry I, it's certainly true that he wants to go to back to that sort of era. Of course, it can't be done, but I mean, he's also thoroughly meant, there's a lot of weasel words in this. I mean, many of the things that are so-called, he defines or he demands as the so-called ancestral customs at Clarendon, I mean, some of them are ancestral customs and quite a few of them aren't. Or it's the most exceptional, extreme example of every topic that's chosen and Henry tries to have it made the norm. I mean, it's a bit like the way that Archbishop Laud redefined the Church of England in the early 17th century. You know, he redefined it as something that it actually, you know, hadn't been before. It's this sort of game that Henry's trying to play. And Becket knows that if someone doesn't take a stand, you know, the Church's cause will be lost by default. And I mean, Henry's not just doing it. See, the other thing you see is that Henry's not just doing this in England to Becket. He's also trying to do it on the continent. Someone like, you know, John of Canterbury, who becomes, who's also been one of Theobald's talk, who becomes Bishop of Poitiers. I mean, he notices this and points this, his letters point this out. Henry's acting in ways that it would be perfectly legitimate at the time to denounce as tyrannical. In the same way that Henry VIII was doing things at the time of the break with Rome and afterwards that can legitimately be denounced as tyrannical. But of course, seeing tyranny is also a point of view. That one man's strong government is another man's or another woman's tyranny. And of course, it's the way that people engage with the supreme power and the attitudes that they have that colour this question. But if you're reading the books that Becket was reading, which are the same books that Thomas More was reading, which is basically, you know, the, if you like, Cicero, Strokes and Ambrose, Seneca, you are going to see that sort of ruler as a tyrant.
Do you think Henry intended to have Becket killed?
I don't think there's, I mean, I explain this in my book, I mean, I don't actually think there's a huge amount of doubt about what Henry wanted. Henry sent his own chaps, Mandeville, Earl of Essex, and Richard de Humes. He sends them over to basically take Becket and basically lock him up. The equivalent of house arrest or a dungeon or something like that, but it was not in Henry's interest to have Becket killed. And by the way, you know, of course, I mean, I think this was perhaps already known, but I was able to show where the phrase came from. I mean, Henry never said, "Who will rid me of this turbulent priest?" But nor did George Lord Lyttelton in his History of Henry II. Yeah. I mean, he did say it, but he wasn't the first to say it. It was first electronic searching aids enabled me to find out, you know, fairly quickly that a guy called Thomas Mortimer, about 3 years before, in a book called A New History of England, in two volumes, had sort of made up this quote. "Who will rid me of this turbulent priest?" Now, there are actually three or four different versions of what Henry is supposed to have said. But in a nutshell, he said pretty much what he'd said at Chinon in a similar sort of rage in 1166, which is, what, 4 years before. Basically, "Who are all these useless drones, courtiers, who clutter up my court, none of whom can help me to get even with one single priest?" And actually, Nicholas, the wonderful Nicholas Vincent, who wrote an article on the you know, who were these four knights and what happened to them not so long ago, you know, has pointed out that these are essentially, if you like, they are knights at Henry's court. Three of them have probably been Becket's knights in the past when he was Chancellor, but they've gone over to Henry's service. They're relatively unknown at Henry's court. They're on the fringes of intimacy with the king. They make it their business to try and do Henry's business. And they reap the rewards, and they go off having misunderstood what Henry has said, and they go off and they actually go off on their own to kill Becket, thinking that this is what Henry actually wants. I mean, what Henry's a guy who had these rages. He would go off into it. He would. There's one wonderful occasion where he's angry with Richard de Humes, who's Constable of Normandy, and who was enraged him, and he just sort of goes ballistic. I mean, he tears off his silk clothes, throws them. Well, he tears off his clothes, throws them on the floor. His clothes aren't silk, but he pulls down the silk velours off his beard. You know, he rolls around on the floor and finishes up eating straw. It's all described in correspondence. He can get into the incredible rage, and I think those his courtiers who knew him well knew that you didn't take any notice of him at that moment. And you didn't basically, you know, one of his secretaries said, you know, he'll be furious in the morning, he'll be absolutely fine with you in the afternoon. You just had to ignore these rages and then see what he was like a couple of hours later. What you didn't do was when he sounded off about something, you didn't just rush off to do whatever he said because he'd think better of it a bit later. So in a way, I mean, I think it's Nicholas Vincent, and he's absolutely right, and I say the same. It was just bad luck that Henry had this particular tantrum about Becket at this minute in the presence of people who overheard this and then basically went off and decided that they would kill him. Because what Henry wanted, he certainly wanted Becket dealt with. Everybody asks me, you know, did Mary Queen of Scots want Darnley dead? And the answer is no, I don't think she didn't want him dead, and there's absolutely no evidence that she was involved in planning his murder, and certainly not in the gunpowder plot at Kirker Field. But she certainly wanted him locked up. I mean, Darnley had become a dangerous nuisance. Yeah. She wanted him locked up, and it's very clear to me that the idea that Darnley would be essentially put under house arrest and kept there for a very long time at Craigmiller Castle was very much what she had in mind. Well, so with this, would Henry have left Becket in a dungeon to die? Possibly, but you certainly wouldn't have killed him. Certainly wouldn't have had his men killing him. I mean, after all, Henry locks his wife up, doesn't he? I mean, Salisbury, you know, for the best part of 10 years. I don't know if Aquitaine, you know, once she joins this revolt of Prince Henry, the younger King Henry. Although I think that others would know better than I, but I think her confinement was probably rather luxurious at Salisbury.
What was Henry's reaction then to the death of Becket, if this wasn't what he'd intended?
Initially, he just tries to brazen it out. He thinks he can get away with it, at least if he disclaims, you know, responsibility for it and, you know, says, well, I mean, I didn't really call for this. But and also if he can get his messengers to the Pope first. But, of course, he doesn't. Alexander Llewellyn, who was sent with Herbert of Bosham to Paris in 1170, but before, essentially, the assassination happened. Alexander Llewellyn gets there first, but Henry thinks he can brazen it out, but it's too much to brazen out. It is too much to brazen out. Also, he's not sorry. He doesn't even express sorrow about it initially, and then, of course, accepting it. I mean, there's a token. Arnulf of Lisieux says, he's in sackcloth and ashes, and, you know, he's disappeared for 30 days, or, you know, whatever it is, and he won't come out. He was shocked at this news, because he knew it spelt trouble. But after that, he was determined to brazen it out, but he couldn't brazen it out, he had to. But even then, it took a while to, even when he had to do penance, I mean, it took a long time for the Pope's envoys to actually, even to get Henry to come and sort of sort things out, you know, so that there could be this reconciliation with the Church at Avranches, because Henry goes off on a campaign in Ireland, doesn't come back for a bit, keeps them all waiting. But eventually, he has to reconcile himself to the Church, and he has to. It's a sort of, I wouldn't say it's a token penance, because he has to seal a rather stiff Charter of Reconciliation, which is sent out all over, copies of which are sent out all over Europe, and many of the clauses of which Henry tried to sort of airbrush out of history. So he is, but he's not, he doesn't wear penitential clothes, and he doesn't, go through the motions. He doesn't go through the ceremonial aspects of being a penitent. He does as little as possible to actually get himself reconciled to the Jew. But of course, later, he has to do he chooses to do a second penance at Canterbury, because once there's a revolt against him, you know, really across his empire, involving his wife, his eldest son, and his younger sons. I mean, once there is a revolt against him. Which he's finding it difficult to deal with. He needs some sort of charismatic ammunition. And for that, you know, a pilgrimage, say, to the shrine of Edward the Confessor won't do. If he can't beat Becket, he has to join him. So he goes to the Becket shrine, and he actually does a second penance. And that one, he does wear penitential clothes. He does walk as a penitent from the, you know, the gates of the city of Canterbury to the cathedral, and goes down to the crypt, to the tomb, and where it was then, the first tomb was in the crypt. He goes down into the crypt, and he puts his, you know, he kneels before the shrine and puts his, there were holes for your head to put your head through, so you could basically kneel and put your head close to the martyr's tomb. And he does that, and sure enough, for Henry, you know, it works that miracles at the shrine of Thomas Becket actually happen, because the very next morning the King of Scots is defeated in battle, who's one of the rebels, and it, so it really looks as if it works for Henry. And after that, Henry goes back. Whenever Henry, there's just one year when the cathedral's closed to visitors because of rebuilding work that he can't go back. Every time he crosses the Channel, he goes and naturally goes to Canterbury on the way back. Henry VIII did the same at the time of the Field of Cloth of Gold. He took Catherine of Aragon and Charles V down to Canterbury and showed them around the cathedral on just on the eve of going over to the Field of Cloth of Gold in 1520. And when Henry comes back, he also goes back to Canterbury to the shrine. So, and then later, when Louis VII comes to France, comes to the shrine. I mean, then the thing just takes off. I mean, it just becomes a... I mean, it's the most important shrine in England, I mean, the medieval pilgrimage site in England. I mean, it inspires Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and, you know, in the 20th century, it inspired T.S. Eliot's murder in the cathedral.
Why do you think the Becket cult grew so quickly?
Well, the story was a particularly gruesome one. I mean, the assassination story is a bit... I mean, and, of course, John of Salisbury and, you know, the early biographers, the early hagiographers, really, they are. I mean, they told the story well. I mean, Becket's made as a saint by the Pope incredibly fast, you know, within 3 years. In 1173, he's made a saint. The decree's issued at Ash Wednesday by Alexander III, the Pope. And, of course, the... you know, there was just a large amount of evidence that the blood of Thomas Becket, I mean, miracles supposedly happened, you know, within hours of the murder, when the blood was, you know, beginning to coagulate. And, of course, then it was collected by the monks and it was watered down, and there was this thing called the Water of Canterbury, which they sold at the shrine, you know, sort of as souvenirs. But, I mean, there's just a huge amount of evidence that, you know, people seem to think it worked. And it also appealed to all social classes. It appealed to not just, you know, the affluent and the rich, but it also appealed to the, you know, the poor and women and priests and so on, you know, to women in childbirth, and you know, people would go for all sorts of things to just basically find out things, you know where lost servants were, where stolen rings were, you know, anything like this, you know, how to cure sick horses, or, you know, people would go and find out things that, you know, they, of course, they kept Book of Miracles. There were, you know, the books of miracles, which were kept recording all of this, and it just took off. I suspect also that Canterbury is in a interesting position. I mean, it's on the way to Dover, the old Dover. I mean, you go to, essentially, you're at Canterbury on the old Dover Road, really going into to the continent. So there's a regular traffic of people, isn't there, between Europe and London. And if you're going to Oxford or Cambridge or anywhere in the country, you're going to go up that road, and I suppose it's a good place to sort of stop off and pray for a safe crossing across the Channel. But basically, the shrine just took off because of the miracles.
And so, coming forward to the present day, why do you think we're still so fascinated by Thomas Becket?
We're still fascinated about Becket because he's somebody who's incredibly, you know, you might not like him, but he was somebody at the time who was incredibly charismatic, who could walk into a room and people would notice that he had come in, who was incredibly controversial in his own lifetime, and he's divided opinion ever since.
That was John Guy. His biography of Thomas Becket has recently been published by Viking. Look out for a review of the book in BBC History Magazine's June issue. Lawrence Rees, former head of history at the BBC and an expert on the Second World War, has produced a website on that war featuring interviews with historians and veterans from the conflict. The site, www2history.com, was subscription only up until last month when the content was made free. We've taken one of the interviews from the site for you to have a listen to. It's the story of a British mariner. On 12 July 1942, Brian Clark's ship was sunk by a U-boat. He and his comrades then faced an arduous journey in a lifeboat to try and save themselves. Lawrence Rees introduces the piece.
Brian Clark joined the Merchant Navy as a radio officer when he was just 18 years old in 1941. The following year, he was serving on board a merchant ship called the Cythonia, en route across the Atlantic to South America with a cargo of coal. When one night, disaster struck.
When I was lying in my bunk asleep, waiting for the quartermaster to call me from my midnight watch, at 10:30, there was an almighty explosion, which is quite a traumatic business, an explosion. I don't know how close you've ever been to one, but it doesn't sort of stop at attacking your ears. You become the epicentre of the noise. It's very odd. Your whole body is sort of suddenly enveloped in noise, and you become part of the noise. However, the torpedo, and I knew instantly what it was, even though I was fast asleep, it threw me out of my bunk. I was in the top bunk, so this was about 6 feet above the deck, and it threw me out of my bunk and onto the floor of the cabin, which, by the time I got there, amazingly in all this, the speed of it is quite stunning. By the time I hit the floor, was already a few inches deep in water.
Brian managed to get out of his cabin, up onto the deck, and into a lifeboat.
Then the old Cythonia, she slipped down and to the bottom. You know, she suddenly gave up the ghost and went down. And it's all a bit sad, really, because she's your home. Not much of a home, it's true, but all your possessions and things are on it. So that's a bit of a bad moment.
One other lifeboat had been launched with them, and the sailors in both boats now started to discuss just what they should do next.
The atmosphere was okay then, because we were new to it and we realised that we were only 350 miles from the Canary Islands anyway, which is not a terribly long journey. And so we were kind of buoyed up, full of hope, because A, we were uninjured, B, we survived, and C, we were in a lifeboat. Although they look, I have to say, lifeboats look very tiny compared with the Atlantic Ocean, which is absolutely massive. And then, in the middle of our deliberations, came a big shout across the water on a megaphone in perfect English. "What ship are you?" And it was the U-boat commander. And we said, "The Cythonia." And he said, "Is your captain aboard?" Well, the captain was aboard. He was in our boat. But we said, no, he went down with the ship, because they used to take senior officers and interrogate them. Then the chief officer, he was a bit worried that we were going to be machine-gunned by the U-boat's commander, so he was saying, "Don't shoot us, don't shoot us." And I must say I had more faith in human nature than he had. I couldn't see anybody turning machine guns on people in a lifeboat somehow. Anyway, he said, "Have you any injured men?" And we said, "No." All this is in splendid English. I often wonder how many British submariners could have addressed a German crew in German. Not so many, I suspect. However, he was very good, most concerned. "Have you any injured men?" "No." "Do you know where you are?" "Yes." "Your position is this," and he gave us our position, which we knew. And he said, "Did you get a distress signal away?" And we said, "No, we didn't. The radio was damaged." And he said, "Right, give me your call sign and I'll send a distress message for you." Now, whether he ever did or not, I honestly don't know. But he said he would. And then he said, "Are you all right for cigarettes, blankets?" That was the next question. We said, "Well, we don't really need blankets. We're south of the Canary Islands, you know, don't need blankets." And so he said, "Are you all right for cigarettes?" So we said, "No." So, as good as gold, he went down his conning tower and came back a moment or two later and said, "I'm terribly sorry, but we're short of cigarettes as well." So we didn't get any cigarettes from him. But his intentions were good. So, with a shout of bon voyage, he slid off into the darkness. We rationed the water because there was not a lot of water. Some of the barrels had been broached. The chocolate was missing, or some of the chocolate was missing, and the food we had in the boat was pemmican, which is a kind of meat concentrate paste. Frightful stuff. And we had ship's biscuits, and we also had Horlicks tablets and some chocolate. So that was our diet. And so after about the fourth day or the fifth day, we woke up one morning, daybreak, to see that the other boat was no longer there. So that was a bit of a blow, you know. It sort of knocks your morale a bit, because you don't know whether it's gone down in the night, sunk in the night, or been picked up, or whatever. Anyway, so that was that. So we were on our own. And it becomes a bit more lonely, if you will. So we kept on sailing, and we could see that the water was going down fast, so we were really keeping our rations low. Because the funny thing is, if you don't have anything to drink, you don't make much saliva. And when you don't have any saliva, you don't eat anything. At that time, we were drinking probably a couple of tablespoonfuls at daybreak, a couple of tablespoonfuls at midday, and a couple of tablespoonfuls at sunset. But it was only at that stage that we realised, after we'd been at sea about 7 days, we realised that we had missed the Canary Islands. Somehow, we'd made a mess of it navigationally, and we'd missed them. Unfortunately, you'd think you were literally in the same boat together, but it isn't like that. Human nature is rather horrid, really, and the atmosphere was pretty grim. We had a number of different nationalities in the boat, and one nationality would say that another nationality was getting more than their whack of water, and, you know, and so on. So the atmosphere was not good, and there were lots of incidents where people would get their knives out and were going to slit somebody else's throat, and so on and so on. And you were in a confined space. You're suddenly deprived of smoking. And if you've ever given up smoking, you know, you feel bad-tempered. So the atmosphere was not good. We were not eating, we were not drinking, and we were not getting anywhere, which was worse. And then the captain said, rather than start looking around for the Canary Islands, which would have been quite a difficult job, really, he said we really ought to make travel east until we got to Africa. So this caused a lot of recrimination within the boat. Some people said, well, we haven't got enough water to get to Africa, you know. It's going to be another 500 miles or something. However, that was what we finally decided to do. We took a vote on it, and we decided that if we kept going east, Africa was so big that you can't really miss it very well, even us. And so we carried on going east, and then we realised that we hadn't got enough water for everybody. And I can remember sitting in the stern of the boat thinking, now, we're not all going to make it. And you wonder if it's going to be him, or him, or him. And so we had to cut the ration, the water ration, down from 2 tablespoonfuls to 1 tablespoonful, which is very, very little water if you stop to think about it, especially in that part of the world. The sun beats down mercilessly during the day, and it's staggeringly hot, no shade. And then at night time, as soon as the sun goes down, it's bitterly, bitterly cold, very cold indeed. So you begin to get into a bit of a state. And the first incident, I suppose, was one of the firemen, Ephebo. And he suddenly said, I'm going to swim ashore. I'm too young to die. So he jumped over the side and started swimming. Well, I mean, this is nonsense, really. So I said to the skipper, aren't we going to pick him up, sir? And he said, certainly not. He said, if that man is mad enough to think he can swim ashore, he's mad. And he said, we haven't got room in this boat for mad people. Besides, he said, it's one less mouth for water. And, of course, he was absolutely correct, I've since thought. So, poor old Ephebo, we watched him swim away to his death. Some of the chaps started filling their Horlicks tin, or whatever they had, mug or something, with salt water, sea water. And I can remember saying to one guy who was from Bolton, I said, what are you doing that for? He said, I'm going to drink it. He said, I'm going to leave it out in the sun, and the sun will extract all the impurities from it, and it will become fresh. And I didn't believe that. So he started to drink salt water, sea water, and some of the others followed suit. And I must say that it made a big difference to them. They became feverish and would flop about in a frenzy in the bottom of the boat, which was always awash anyway. There was always a foot of water in it. On about the 19th day, we spotted the land. So this was very cheering. But it took us another 2 days to get there. We were rowing like mad, although we were weak at this stage, And where we'd had one man on an oar in the beginning, we now had to have two men, because we weren't strong enough to manage the oars. We did make it to land, and in the Atlantic, even in calm weather, the breakers are pretty huge. And these breakers flung us up onto the beach and crashed our boat, smashed it to smithereens. And it threw us up onto the beach. And the worst thing of that day was that, well, there were two worst things, really. One was that one of the guys had died the day we got there. And the other thing was that our water barrel was also shattered. To see our nice fresh water going into the sand was a bit of a blow. So we dragged the poor chap who died, he was a young man, my age indeed, a fireman from Liverpool, and we dragged him up above the waterline and dug him a shallow grave in the sand, and as far as I know, he's still there. Then we looked around us, and we'd landed, of all places, in the Sahara Desert. So we were sitting there, wondering what we were going to do.
Then Brian and his shipmates noticed a group of tribesmen staring at them.
We made them understand that we wanted water, so they said yes. So they sent four men on two camels out into the desert, to an oasis, presumably, to get water. And they were away forever, and we were pretty desperate by then. However, they did come back, and they had goat skins, absolutely bulging with water, which was lovely. So we sort of ran forward and held out our mugs and tins and things to get it, and they wouldn't give it to us. But they wanted an exchange. They wanted to barter. And so all sorts of daft things changed hands. You know, pound notes. I mean, what good is a pound note in the Sahara Desert? And I'd got an old greatcoat there with brass buttons on. So I cut a brass button off, and I got water for a brass button. And somebody else got something for a watch or a belt buckle. And one chap even traded his false teeth. But anyway, there we are. So we lived with these people. They became a little more understanding as we stayed with them. They were a fishing community of about 80 people, men, women and children. And they had two or three tents, and we slept outside, and we helped them a bit with the fishing. They fished for a man who would come down the coast who had a fish canning factory up in a place called Rio de Oro, because we had landed in Mauritania.
Brian and his comrades were subsequently taken up the coast to Dakar, and from there, after a brief period of captivity at the hands of the Vichy French, managed to return to Britain. Brian landed back at Gourock in Scotland in January 1943. But his view of human nature had been forever changed by his experience, and he certainly didn't have feelings of affection for the men he'd shared his terrible ordeal with.
I hope I never see any of those men again, and I'm sure they feel the same about me. They wouldn't want to know me. Which is a shame, really, when you think, as I say, that most people are nice. But I suspect that this niceness is just a very thin veneer until you get down to the nitty-gritty.
So those were the words of Brian Clark, and they were voiced by Michael Burrell. You can hear more of this material at www2history.com, and they'll also find interviews there with noted historians such as Anthony Beaver, Adam Tooze, Richard Evans and Sir Ian Kershaw. Now just time for a quick reminder that tickets are still available for the third in our BBC History magazine Tower of London lecture series. This talk brings together two historians to discuss the reigns of the two Elizabeths, the Tudor Elizabeth I and the current Elizabeth II. Anna Whitelock and Kate Williams will be considering their lives and queenships. The event takes place on the 14th of June. Go to historyextra.com/tower lecture for more information. That's all for this episode. We will return next week when we'll be considering Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812 and talking about the Bamiyan Buddhas. In the meantime, keep an eye on our website, historyextra.com, for blogs, quizzes, galleries and more. Plus, don't forget you can find our new Kindle and iPad editions on the Amazon website and Apple Newsstand, respectively. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson.